So yes, this one of the things I found writing this was I'd end up in the most ridiculous rabbit holes of activity. There's a couple in the backup slides. One of my favorites, which is a woman who ran a society called Atomic Gardening, which had heavy halal support and was very keen on irradiated food. So in fact, to the extent that she went to the newspaper for eating a roast dinner that had been cooked 3 years before and left in a strawberry in a harbour with a radioactive isotope and thus irradiated, but perfectly safe to eat. And well, I don't know how tasty it was. But honestly, it's a cracking read. It's really interesting to go back to a period of very strong enthusiasm about nuclear power, about the nuclear era, and optimism about the future that maybe we have now lost in some ways. So yeah, I'm not a historian. I have selected things like interesting, which is rather almost selling sets. I have a few sources. So the Harwell book, Harwell, The Enigma Revealed, which came out about 20 years ago for the 60th anniversary, and Independence and Deterrence, Britain and Atomic Energy. I've managed to get bits of this, but couldn't get full access to a copy in this time. But this is an official UK Atomic Energy Authority history from 1974. And various fellow Royal Society biographies, particularly John Adams, Geoffrey Pickmans, and Godfrey Stafford. The last one of those written was by Norman Govan, who maybe you know completely. The final one is a very interesting one, Science Policy Under Thatcher. I don't know, I mean, you could read the whole 300 thing, I think it's interesting. Just going through that, the mentions of CERN and Rutherford, Harwell, ISIS is extremely informative about what was happening in the 80s and where we get to now. Okay, so RAF Harwell. So built in 1935 during British rearmament, so the interwar period when decided to do lots of rearming, and then operational from 1937. It's a split between Chiltern, East Henwood, and Harwell parishes. Report suggested the commanding officer decided on RAF Harwell after location of his house. This is a story I've seen in various places. What I have looked up more recently is the actual locations of this. So this is the parish that they were at the time. So you can see Harwell is up here, Chiltern is down here, East Henwood is here. And then if we look at that superimposed on the modern map, you can see that a decent bulk of the site is in Chiltern, some bits in Harwell, and a reasonable chunk in East Henwood as well. For whatever reason, the UK Health Security Agency has been very keen on referring to the site at Chiltern, but obviously Harwell is stuck in many places for other things. So RAF Harwell looked a bit like this. This is an aerial photograph from 1940, late 1944 or something. So you can see the runways on here. So various bits of this still around, some of the buildings still around. And I guess two things to bring out. So obviously you could probably do an entire, you could definitely do an entire military history seminar on the kind of things that happened. So an interesting one is the prototype gas fault launch system for aircraft. So this was built here on a field, which is now where the new Moderna buildings are. So that was excavated a couple of years ago, and you can see the outline of that. And some of that was also used for storage related to nuclear activities on site. And the other thing that happened, this also is a memorial for this, is various operations, including wooden airspeed hawser gliders, which were then sent for D-Day landings. So essentially, you have a big glider full of soldiers and equipment. You can then launch it silently from an aircraft, and then it would either crash in a surprisingly high number of cases, or it would land, and then people would get out and do war things. Okay, so how do we go on to atomic energy from here? So we had a meeting. So various things happened during World War II, which I won't go into. That again would be a sort of own seminar. But yeah, the UK contribution to the Manhattan Project was significant. It was under the code name Tube Alloys. And towards the end of all of this, Chadwick, Oliphant, Cockcroft, Biles, Harry Massey, and Herbert Skinner all had a meeting in Washington November 1944. So the things they wanted were they wanted a location that was near Oxford or Cambridge, because those were internationally important nuclear physics laboratories. Cockcroft had a preference for Cambridge. To me, it's not immediately clear why only Oxford, given that there were substantial nuclear physics groups at other universities, Birmingham, Bristol, Manchester, Liverpool, there are. It's not obvious to me that it had to be Oxford or Cambridge, but there is a thing in this country where if something can be put near Oxford or Cambridge, then it is. We'll actually come back to that later. But in fairness, proximity to to London was also likely to be a factor which would rule out a lot of places in the Midlands or North or really Scotland. And it was to be run as part, so this organisation was also to be run as part of the Ministry of Supply, which was a government department which supplied equipment to armed forces in a fairly broad definition of the word. Okay, so this location, former RAF station, would be ideal. You could construct atomic piles and hangars, and you already had a lot of utilities and services that were already present. So the Air Ministry were not very keen on giving up any of their airfields that they had. So many of them had built up so massively. So they offered Duxford and Debden, but they also wanted to keep East Anglian airfields for Cold War. So Duxford or Debden were the only ones that they wanted to keep. Duxford being fairly near Cambridge, is now an airfield and the Imperial War Museum, so you can go there, it's a good day out, you can see lots of planes and hangars and so on. Under these, Duxford did not have enough water supply, so they knew that they would need to cool all the reactors. And in Debden, the water table was too high, so unsuitable for burying waste. The standards of nuclear waste storage at the time were not what they are now. Nevertheless, so these two were brought out. So they went back and said, you need to give up one of your other airfields. So the options they went through, there's a longer list. I haven't been able to say exactly what, but we can see all of these on this. So we've got Oxford and Cambridge, we've got Cambridge in red, Oxford in red, London over here. So you can see Debden and Duxford being two Cambridge adjacent ones, so Debden being sort of near south of Walden. And then the ones that they're interested in, RAF Benson, RAF Harwell, both obviously in the local area here. And then RAF South Cerny near Cirencester, so north of Swindon. And there's a couple of more distant ones. So RAF Pershore, which is near Evesham, Worcester, that kind of area up towards Coventry. And RAF Netheravon, which is down here near Basingstoke. So these ones are excluded as too distant for what they wanted. It came down to Harwell and Benson. And the choice between Harwell and Benson was settled over a meal of bread, cheese, beer, and pickled onions at a now demolished pub in Chilton Village, the Horse and Groom. An important historical footnote is that the Plowman's Lunch was only popularised as a term after this meeting. So at the time, they would not likely have referred to it as a Plowman's Lunch. But this was a cheese bureau attempt to get people to eat more cheese, which succeeded massively. Okay, so foundation. Prime Minister. So Churchill was involved in the early stages, but was no longer Prime Minister at the same end. So Clement Attlee announced the foundation of the Atomic Energy Research Establishment at Harwell, 29th of October 1945. What's interesting here, and I don't have time, I don't understand exactly what was going on in everyone's heads or on paper. The decision as to actually build an atomic bomb was not taken until over a year later. But they kind of set up a lot of the stuff they knew they would need for either civil or military nuclear production. But this is an interesting point, I think, in terms of what people were thinking about. It was decided that the UK would be a nuclear power in the broader sense. We would have some nuclear stuff. Right. So we can look this up in Hansard, so we can see the transcript of the debate in Parliament. So Mr. W.S. Morrison asked the Prime Minister what steps are being taken to develop research on the use of atomic energy in this country. The Prime Minister, in accordance with the recommendation, blah, 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 the government had decided to set up a research and experimental establishment covering all aspects of the use of atomic energy. Accommodation is being provided for the establishment at Harwell Airfield near Didcot. It finds that the danger is negligible. In view of the importance to this work to the service departments, responsibility for research on the subject So it was at that point with the Department of Scientific and Industrial Research, so an early precursor to the sort of science ministry, DSIC kind of entity we have now. Has hitherto rested with them, should be transferred to the Ministry of Supply. The Tube Alloys Directorate, so this was the code name for the British contribution to the Patent Project, and will accordingly become part of that ministry. The DSIR will be represented on by the committee. Mr. Morris, can the Right Honourable Gentleman say what financial assistance it is proposed to give to this research? Prime Minister, the cost will have to fall upon the government, which is the kind of non-answer that I don't know if you get away with. Mr. Blackline, is the Right Honourable Gentleman aware that research on atomic energy is inseparable from production, and really effective research would involve an expenditure of at least £30,000 or £40,000? The Prime Minister, I'm very fully advised on these matters. Does this change of control to department more closely associated with the military indicate the government are more concerned about the weapon value than its production value? The Prime Minister, no, not at all. The Ministry of Supply is also engaged on civilian production. It is a mistake to suggest it is entirely concerned with weapons. And of course, at this point, they hadn't decided to build the weapon. So this is true. Will the Right Honourable Gentleman consider making the report of the Advisory Committee available to members of this House? No, sir, I could not accept that. So I don't know if that was ever released. Advisory report. If you go on the Bank of England website, you can look up what 30 to 40 million would buy you, which is quite helpful. So inflation has increased by a factor of 3,000 in this time. So this is about 1.5 billion in today's money. This is actually, I think, a lowball estimate for how much it would take even now from scratch to build your own nuclear program. In 1945, 40,000 was a colossal, 40 million was a colossal sum. You could have built 50,000 new homes, 100,000 new cars, several major warships. So, a lot of money. And what did we get for this? So, 1947, a lot of houses were built. So, prefabs, small, bungalows that looked a bit like this. Some picture of those. Okay, and the rest of the structure that was set up at the time. So this was kept within the government ministry rather than being spun out as a separate organisation. The Department of Atomic Energy, was down under the controller, Lord Portal, who, at least by some accounts, was a complete waste of space, did not do any controlling. He was there, he was a figurehead, and the deputy controllers, three of them, at least initially, did all the actual work. So, Hinton is an engineer who worked on production, and this is this Risley headquarters up in Warrington. John Cockcroft was responsible for research, which was, of course, based at Harwell, as we discussed. And then William Penny was on the weapon making. So despite the fact that, as was previously advertised, there was no plan to actually build a weapon at this point, this started off at Fort Halstead, so a sort of defence research establishment in Sevenoaks in Kent. And that was moved to RAF Aldermaston, where it is so another old RAF base in 1950, and that's where that side of things is to this day, essentially. So the first reactor, so things got off the ground quite quickly. So 1st January 1946 was the start of things. The graphite low energy experimental pile was the first whole reactor and first in Western Europe. And it was a top priority. So there was steel that was intended to repair Parliament, which had been bombed in World War II. And that was diverted to Harwell, when critical on the 15th of August 1947 with 100 watts, so approximately one light bulb or one old incandescent light bulb, design power of 100 kilowatts, and then operated largely at 3 kilowatts until 1990. It was actually the last of the reactors to be decommissioned, so first in, last out. It cost about 2.5 million in currency at the time, what is 5 million today. And a lot of other reactors were built over the years at Harwell. So these are here in order. So Gleep, Beppo, Dido, Pluto. There's a few different ones that kind of turn up there. Neptune is kind of moderate interest because that was moved from Harwell to the nuclear submarine construction place at Derby, which is a Rolls-Royce facility now, and that is still operational. So that is the UK's only research reactor. This is all public information, although I think the connection between Neptune Harwell and Neptune Derby is not in that many places. But nevertheless, there's a report on it from International Atomic Energy Authority. So it's relatively fine. The favourite name of these, Dido and Pluto's handmaiden for nuclear experiments. So a strong tradition and terrible acronyms that survives to this day. Okay, so where do we go from here? So world's first synchrotron. One of the things I did not realise until I started this was that world's first synchrotron was started in the UK. So there was a Betatron sent from the US to the Royal Arsenal at Woolwich, so in East London, for bomb disposal tasks. So never actually used, and the team there realised they could convert it to a synchrotron. Managed to achieve 8 MeV in August 1946, 2 months before the American effort. And that was later shipped to Malvern to the telecommunications research establishment, so it's a sort of radar-related place. And there's a picture, here. There's quite a detailed history of this. J.D. Lawson wrote, I guess, about 30 years ago, which leads me neatly on to John Adams, who's a kind of figure who intersects a lot of the different parts here. So he was born in 1920, had an early career in radar at Swanage Malvern. So he never took a degree. His, at least according to his Royal Society biography, it's because his father was shell-shocked from World War II, and the family, you know, he was obviously extremely bright, but they couldn't support him going to university, so he had to go straight into a technical profession. But he was involved in the synchrotron project at Malvern. So he moved to AERE Harwell to work on accelerators in 1955, and was then one of the sort of first round of people to move to CERN in 1953, and led the proton synchrotron project. There's a nice picture of him here. He's essentially never seen without a pipe. I thought for a little while that he didn't have a pipe in this picture, but of course it's in one of his hands, and he's got a microphone in the other. So they're having a good time around the commissioning of the proton synchrotron. There's, yeah, a few staff there. Okay, you'll do it. Yeah, so after his sort of initial stint at CERN, including being interim director after the death of Cornelius Bacher, the first, who was CERN director general at the time, he then became column director and was then CERN director general, properly elected again, 1971 to 1980. So an interesting career. Okay, so the Harwell synchro cyclotron is where I was going with this. Yeah, so John Adams was one of the people who worked on this. So this was the first kind of big accelerator at Harwell. So this was 110 inches diameter. So the synchro cyclotron is like a normal cyclotron, except with a compensation for the relativistic, the particles getting relativistic and the effect this has on their orbits. There's a nice series of drawings that you can see on the Science Museum website, which happily are now out of copyright. First time I found these, they were in copyright, and I'm going through loads of problems with this. But yeah, these were drawings that were done for a mural, which I've never found, for the atomic energy mural that was going to be presented at the Festival of Britain in 1951. So again, part of the nuclear optimism here. Okay, so another accelerator that came up was the Tandon Van de Graaff. So this is used for material testing and nuclear physics between 1959 and 2002. It was demolished in 2005. Although it wasn't clear to me, this is apparently two attempts to demolish. I don't really know why it was demolished, when you could just probably reuse the building, I guess. I don't know. Certainly that's the case at Darsbury with their Van de Graaff generator. And I found a paper from 2021, which is an analysis of a 1990 experiment. So it's nice to know that people are still looking into this. The proton linear accelerator is another big machine. This was started in 1954 due to a planned 600 and had a planned 600 MeV energy. So the reason for this was there was a belief that if you had that energy, you could get a lot of neutrons. Target. This turned out to be a mismeasurement. This was too low an energy for this. So it ended up just being 50 MeV in the end. It was moved to RAL, which I guess I haven't covered yet. But yeah, the R12 building around in 1960. Okay, so the whole accelerators. So we kind of go through some of these. So 110 inch synchro cyclotron, 170 MeV. Electron linear accelerator, Yeah, so not operating for very long in this case. And then, Cockcroft bought some accelerator, Electron nano accelerator, Proton nano accelerator around for a number of years. And then, Van de Graaff generator, another Electron LINAC, a tandem Van de Graaff, which was also just there, variable energy cyclotron, which ran until the 1980s, and then kind of three versions of the Electron linear accelerator, Helios. So it was kind of a maximum energy of 136 MeV, and then the different sections of that were chopped out to do smaller Electron LINACs. And the building for Helios is actually kind of opposite ISIS on the other side of the fence. So it's one of the banded buildings, people have been for walking around the site, and turns out to be what's in that building. And there's some sources here from Victoria's website talking computing. The particular history for the Helios LINACs, which I haven't covered here, it comes from Lechwood, who Victoria told me died. All right, so where does this leave us with UK AEA? Nuclear energy was moved out of Ministry of Supply to a separate agency in 1954. And then I made this, this is quite fun actually, this Sankey diagram of what happens to the various bits. So essentially, the gradual divestment of functions, weapons, fuel processing, isotopes until only the fusion programs left, and then a 21st century resurgence in the new locations. So they've got a new site in Rotherham at the advanced nuclear advanced manufacturing park campus, research campus. And there's plans for a tokamak for energy production, the West Burton former coal power station in Nottinghamshire, which is meant to come online in the 2040s, and will produce some band energy, is the idea then. We can go through the different bits that got kind of hived off. So the first one, the foundation, 1954. And at some point here, Rutherford High Energy Laboratory set up. I haven't covered that, and the Sankey diagram is getting a little bit too complicated at this point. In 1971, there's a recognition that the different parts should do different things. So the radiochemical center, which produced isotopes for medical applications and so on, is hived off. And so that's in pink. So that was a government-owned company, but one that was intended to produce things for profit and operate in a more commercial way. So not a privatization exactly, but a companyization, I guess. And British Nuclear Fuels Limited, so all the reprocessing, fuel processing and so on, was also hived off. And then, in 1973, Radiochemical Centre became Amersham PLC, so then a fully private company, which was then sold to American GE Healthcare, and then at some point it was just wound down, so there is no more of that. So other bits that are happening, so British Nuclear Fuels Limited had a somewhat tortured history, and there should be more bits coming off here. But the interesting thing is that the Dorman Company, British Nuclear Fuels Limited, was then reactivated and became Great British Nuclear, and then the Labour government renamed that Great British Energy - Nuclear in 2023. And then all the bits related to the kind of fission sort of facilities for research and so on, that became the UK National Nuclear Laboratory in 2008. There's a recognition that some of the stuff was not being done in the private sector, so it had to be done there. So let's have a little look at the top of this graph. This is 1995, so just further privatization. So AEA Technology Limited was set up as a fully private entity, and then that was sold to become Ricardo AEA, and then Ricardo Energy Environment, which you see have a sort of big site on campus and a large just an energy an environment consultancy without, as far as I'm aware, particularly nuclear flavor nowadays. And another big split in 2004. So we basically have UK fusion only, as opposed to the state column, other locations. And then the decommissioning side, which is obviously becoming increasingly important over time, comes in. it comes in there as well. So they get signed up to the Nuclear Decommissioning Authority, and there's some kind of cross-link between British Nuclear Fuels and NDA. But and also they lost control of the UK AA police. So that then becomes Civil Nuclear Conservatory, and then starts behaving, starts being on the same footing as the other police services. So we go that. So usually a little bit more on this. And so the Soviet visit to Harwell in 1956. This was the first visit of Soviet leaders Bulgin and Khrushchev to the west. And they arrived in Portsmouth by a cruiser, escorted by two destroyers, and then had a bit of a journey, I guess, to London and Harwell. And Igor Khrushchev, who said the Soviet nuclear program, revealed that they had a nuclear fusion program, and they were doing similar work to the US and the UK on pinches and other methods of plasma confinement. So he shared all the details there, which was all secret at the time. I learned in this that Khrushchev was referred to as the beard. You can see he has a very long beard, kind of down to about here in this photo. Other photos of him show the beard more clearly, but I ran out of time to put them in. I guess depends on your priorities when you're choosing photos. So the next interesting thing that happened with fusion Harwell was ZETA, so Zero Energy Thermonuclear Assembly. So this was, yeah, a toroidal machine, but not a tokamak, just a kind of pinch confinement, so that's successful confinement. And yeah, when they started running with deuterium, they had a huge neutron flux observed, which they attributed internally to fusion, and then became gradually more certain about. And there were, although work at Harwell was largely secret at this point, there were leaks and rumours. The press conference in January 1958, I quite like this, so you can see John Cockcroft is down here. At one table, and then some journalists over here, and you can see the TV cameras and so on. And you can see, yeah, danger, extra high voltage from the ZETA machine behind them. But they had they had quite an awkward climb down. So it's actually a bit in between the press conference. They had a Brussels World Expo, and there was a small model of the ZETA machine there at a model of an English pub called The Lion and Unicorn, I think. I can recommend a book about this. So anyway, they had as we all know, they did not solve fusion power in 1958. So they had an awkward climb down. A few months later, the neutrons are coming from plasma instabilities. A lot of experts at the time thought that the claimed temperature was not high enough to produce fusion anyway. So fusion research was moved to yet another airfield, Royal Naval Air Service Column 60, where it continues to this day. Okay, so what comes next? National Institute for Research in Nuclear Science, or NIRNS. So Enoch Powell, who is better known for later work, by which I mean becoming incredibly racist, or at least announcing that he was very racist and doing a speech about these things. He, at the time, was the Secretary to the Treasury and had not revealed any particularly acceptable views at the time. So he announced the founding of a new academic lab at Harwell on Valentine's Day, 1957. So it's another planted question here. Ask the Chancellor of the Exchequer, will state what steps are being taken for the establishment of the National Centre for Nuclear Physics, where the Atomic Energy Authority and universities cooperate in research in nuclear physics. So one of the problems this was trying to solve was that there was a big fence around Harwell and, you know, armed police and a general air of secrecy. Although, you know, increasingly work was more civil at this point, but it's felt that a laboratory without a fence, or at least with a less severe fence, would be a, you know, with more cooperation directly with universities, from the universities feeling like they were clients of UK AA would be useful. So a consultation between University Grants Committee, so a kind of precursor to research councils, AEA, and Advanced Concerns, government have decided to set up the National Institute for Research in Nuclear Science to provide common use by universities and others facilities and equipment beyond the scope of individual universities and institutions. It will not replace the research being done in individual universities. So this was a concern for universities because they, you know, in many cases have built reasonably substantial accelerators at this point, and were concerned that they were going to be, you know, kind of sidelined in favour of this thing. It will not replace the research being done, nor will it affect the government's participation in the international scheme for common facilities in Geneva. So this was, of course, a few years after CERN had been officially founded in 1954. So there was, yeah, I mean, not really that much discussion of how this affected CERN from a lot of people involved in this at that time. But more on that a bit later. And this was run as a subsidiary of UK AEA in 2005, run the Earth and Science Research Council, which is basically a precursor to what we have now. The Research Council was. Okay, so this is quite fun. Standards for working at height changed a lot since the 1950s. These guys could just fall off the roof, I think. But yeah, so they built Nimrod, National Institute Machine Radiator Downs. That was at least one of the claims for its name. Don't know if that's the background where people were going with this. But yeah, this area was at this time sort of Berkshire, and was referred to as the Berkshire Downs. Moved to Oxfordshire happened in 1974. Local authority rearrangement. So yeah, so the 7GeV proton synchrotron at what was then being referred to as Rutherford High Energy Lab, based in 1963. So questions about Nimrod. Why build a machine that's powerful than those available in US CERN? So this is something that people are concerned about. There's a nice source material for this, so there's a kind of celebration of Nimrod that contains some quotes on this. So there's a quote from physicist Dennis Wilkinson to Joe Pickfans. Who is under deputy at this point. Our machine is relying for us being a decade too late in its superiority in shielding and provision of experimental facilities. As it stands at the moment, there is some superiority in flux, but there's no advantage of Bertrand. So this is one GV, like multi-GV machine in the US. Other than a slightly higher repetition rate, it may well transpire that the Bertrand can make up for this on the campus much longer duration. Not mentioning the proton synchrotron this way. So Peter Kalmus's final word on this from 1977, he was at that point or later, I'm not sure actually what happened, was that this was, Nimrod should have been built as a strong focusing accelerator of higher energy, but we were lucky. The Nimrod energy proved to be an extraordinarily fruitful one, much like knowledge of hadron spectroscopy sensing this machine. So a lot of kaon and pion interaction comes out of that. So yeah, a little bit more on the design. So there are a few different options coming up. So fixed field alternating gradient options were considered very difficult to build, which I think is fair. And yeah, there are a few sort of weak focusing options. And yeah, so in the end, so something along the lines of 8 or 9 was built. The final beam intensity of 1.5 times 10 to 13 percent. So comparing favorably to its
And of course, there was strong advice from John Adams not to build another strong focusing machine. Right? They're already doing the PS at CERN, and he said it wasn't guaranteed to work, and you didn't want to have two that failed. So that was why they were encouraged by him to continue with the conventional.
That makes sense. Yeah. So we've got a little telegram from Viktor Weisskopf, CERN Director General. Congratulations on the successful startup of Nimrod. Stop all insane gradient. Please have you with us in the field, and I hope we can help each other in building a still stronger base for European physics in the future. Which you could read as code for the UK needs to get more heavily involved in CERN, possibly. But yeah, one of the people signing that was Mervyn Hine, who had gone over with John Adams, and apparently at some point were referred to as the terrible twins when they were at CERN, although I don't know why. It's one of those kind of throwaway statements you see in a biography, you think, what is that? Vicky Weisskopf, Sandy G. And yeah, so the previous source has a kind of, set of different congratulations from different labs around the world. This is a map of the Nimrod beam mines in 1977. So you can see you have two going off here, and various beam mines radiating from here. So kaon, pion, beam mines, and so on. So yeah, there's a big experimental program here that did not feel qualified. Okay, so let's see this. So Dark Beam Laboratory. So before Nimrod was even built, they got permission to build an electron synchrotron at Dark Beam, which as one of these things that keeps coming up, only financially possible by limiting the rate of growth of the CERN budget. So this is a 4 and then 5GeV machine, which operational from 1966. And actually, even before it was operational, there was the first proposal to start using the synchrotron for light source activities, biology and so on. This was shut down in 1977. More on that. So joining the superproton synchrotron, so this 300 GeV proton CERN was going to be extremely expensive, particularly if involved in the laboratory. John Adams was making a strong attempt to bring cost-cutting measures. The UK eventually agreed to join under the condition that the national accelerators were winding down, which is one of those things that keeps, I've never seen a kind of statement of this somewhere, but this is the understanding, certainly for all involved. Yeah, to Nina as well. Did I already say Nina was the, yes, Nina was the name of this emerging synchrotron task group. Northern Institute of National Acceleration. So NINA was shut down in 1977. The infrastructure components were largely reused for the synchrotron radiation source and then NIMROD in 1978. So an interesting point here is Parliament taken. It's epic. So a very serious proposal for a 14 plus 14 GeV colliding electron positron collider to be hosted around. I think it's the kind of final sense of that. So you can see that the NINA would be used as a booster for that. So NINA would presumably be shipped, well, also be shipped for last being on scenario. And then the second stage, which is also interesting, is 200 GeV proton ring for electron and proton collisions. So you could do actually HERA like physics, but you can certainly. Was presented to the Science Research Council in November 1974, around the time of the JSI discovery. So this was approved. So yes, it was a really good idea to do this. But this was killed in practice because Germany announced that they were going to build an electron positron ring. So there's not space for a UK one and a German one, so let's join with that. Similar setup in the US. What's interesting at the time, so this has open questions from the scientific case for EPIC, which, what is the nature of the recently discovered substructure? So this is, 1974, 1975 stuff. What is the nature of the recently discovered substructure of protons and neutrons? What are the properties of these nucleon constituents, brackets, partons? Are the quarks which were invented to explain the properties of the elementary particles the same? Are the quarks the same as partons? So, interesting to me, this was, there was obviously a time when quarks were invented and partons were discovered experimentally, and then some work was emerged. Does the weak interaction have a non-zero range? And if so, what is the mediated particle? So this is something where we know with hindsight that we have to get to 80 GeV to 80 GeV or more to actually see the interaction, see the W and Z bosons. So this is not at the right energy level, but maybe it's just a clue about the zero nature. Are the new theories that unify weakened electromagnetic interactions on the right lines? Another tricky question that I think ends up with SPS or that. Why are there two sorts of neutrinos? Why indeed does a muon exist at all? Are there heavier leptons? These questions that would have been answer. And the tricky one, finally, why does nature distinguish between right and left? And what is the significance of the observed violation of time difference? So that is an open question to this day. Okay, so this was, as I mentioned before, this was canned in favor of participation in the German product. So this brings us neatly onto ISIS. So there were neutron scattering experiments already with Dido, Pluto, and Herald, which is a reactor at Aldermaston, atomic weapons establishment. This was a popular thing for the kind of people who use ISIS now, in the 60s and 70s. And there was a proposal for a British high flux beam reactor, which is almost impossible to find information about because Brookhaven built a high flux beam reactor with the same name. But that proposal was eventually rejected in favour of joining, at the time, France-Germany co-project, the Institut Laue-Langevin at Grenoble. But there was at the time an interest in developing pulse neutron source, pulse correlation source. There had already been some proof that you could do this with the Helios electron LINAC. So you could bombard that onto target, and then it, I believe, it was a two-target setup. So electron to target to uranium target, and then we'd get neutrons from that. So this had already been demonstrated at some level, but more serious pulse correlation source was considered priority. And this gives you a different probe. I don't understand really much about what the differences are, but you can do things on different timescales because you're not getting a continuous neutron stream. When you turn a reactor on, it just produces neutrons all the time until you turn it off. And you can play some games with that, So you can, you know, you can chop the fins on, but generally, spacious also provides different sorts of things. And we know that it's very popular. But yeah, there's a quick study and approval after this 1975 epic cancellation. This would be the next thing, next accelerator. Lab. So, item 3 birth, component for use. So, it was needed to keep costs down. So, a choke from Nina. I don't actually realize in this, I don't know what choke is, but it was a thing that was used on Nina. Nimrod beamline magnets and a 1 megawatt motor alternator set. So, secondhand motor from a Sheffield colliery and a secondhand alternator from the Swedish tramway. So, this came online in 1984, and the rest is history. Okay, do a little interlude. So we're kind of entering Thatcher era now. One fun thing actually that I haven't got on the slides is that in 1983, while ISIS was in quite a late period of construction, they did consider cancelling it. This was discussed in cabinet, why did we cancel the ISIS project? How serious that was, I'm not entirely sure. But yeah, effectively there was a debate on leaving CERN, or at the very least reducing expenditure, which bubbled under from 1983 to 1988. So Robin Nicholson was chief scientific advisor to Margaret Thatcher at the time, and he was not convinced. Withdrawal from CERN must be contemplated as one option. I personally doubt we'll come to that. More likely be recommendations to improve cost effectiveness of CERN, and crucially to slow down the pace and hence the rate of spend on this area of research. There's no reason why the taxpayers of Europe and the USA should have to find a private race between two scientific cliques carried out at a pace determined largely by their own curiosity and arrogance. So very succinct, not very happy. There are actually similar statements from Thatcher at that time. And this was between 1983 when CERN discovered W boson and 1984 when they when CERN scientists would win the Nobel Prize in Physics for discoveries. Still considered, you know, we don't actually need to do this at that pace. Doesn't matter if the discoveries come a bit later. But yeah, I think it's clear. I mean, one of the things that keeps bubbling under is generally a kind of sense that CERN is very expensive. So yeah, there were, you know, various steps taken during this time to try to review this, understand, try to get effectively 15% to 25% reduction in the CERN subscription cost. All of which kind of changed a bit when chief scientific advisor changed from Robin Nicholson to John Fairclough. I think that rank became not so much of a.
Was it this time when Margaret Thatcher was invited to CERN, at a wonderful time, came back saying, yes, we have to do this, and it changed the whole landscape?
No, interesting. This is where, that's in the 1970s when she that would have been the Heath administration when she was a science minister. So at that point, she was quite keen on it. But I think generally her opinions on the utility of fundamental research kind of just, hardened over the 1980s. There's another thing in the book where they suggest that if ISIS operated in the private sector, they'd be making money, things like this. Things, definitely things in the air. And of course, a lot of the things where we change, like the changes to the UK diagram here, that all kind of dates back at the time, but it's less sensitive. But yeah, I think she did change her mind at some point, because the analogy of the Higgs boson, where an eminent person enters a room and they get, mobbed by lots of people, and she being the person who gets mobbed by lots of people, she was very fond of that when that came out in like early 90s or something. That analogy for the Higgs boson. So I think she had a complicated relationship with science, the pure science in particular. Okay. Yes. Okay, diamonds. I think I've managed to lose the source of this. The source of this is a 2022 dig into the archives by the same guy, actually, John Agar, who wrote the science policy on Thatcher. It's a desire in the 1990s to build a new light source. Funding was going to be 50% UK, 30% France, 20% Wellcome Trust. But where should we build? Dalesbury had broad support by a lot of people. It was vetoed by Wellcome Trust, although they apparently would not commit to saying this on paper, but nevertheless, this is in the documents to Tony Blair saying, yeah, Wellcome Trust, it's not a Morale. And Morale was preferred to French due to better proximity to the Eurostar. But of course, the French were going to cancel, they cancelled this in favour of building their own synchrotron anyway. But yeah, so this decision on where this would be sited came to Tony Blair. His chief scientific advisor said that there was just something about Oxford that was wonderful that couldn't be captured by universities in other parts of the country. His scientific advisor, of course, being Oxford's guy. They made the eventual decision. I guess Tony Blair studied Oxford as well. But yeah, the decision came to Tony Blair's desk, and there's a little handwritten memo saying, we have no choice but to go with Ralph. The rest of the diamond's history. Okay, so back to wider kind of Harwell site. So, yeah, Harwell decommissioning. So this has been going on for a long time now. So deep shut down in 1990, and then site commissioning began in 1992. So there's various bits of campus now outside the rail fence, which have already been decommissioned for a long time. All the buildings still had a nice, shiny new ones built. At some point in the 2000s, UK AEA headquarters moved from the Harwell HQ building to Cullen. And there's actually a nice series of documents here. So the Nuclear Restoration Services site group has a six-monthly meeting where they report on progress and how these different things are going, what things are being demolished and all this kind of thing. But yeah, so Harwell Campus, well, Harwell Oxford, Harwell International Business Centre, then Harwell Oxford, then Harwell Campus, joint venture between SGSC, UKAA, and private partners then manages the lease land. So they did a press release a few days ago saying what they're going to do in different places, which has got some fun stuff in there. It's going to be a hotel, it's going to be a playground, it's going to be a museum. So
visitor centre.
Visitor centre. It says a museum and a press release. Well, we will see, I guess. But yeah, that's the demolition of one of the most recent buildings. That's radiochemical facility 2024, I think. Okay, so that brings me neatly to the end of my seminar. So there's lots of stuff that I have not covered. So the MRC Harwell unit, radiobiology, mice, things like that. I have not covered the atomic spies, class books. Someone else whose name escapes me, and then Bruno Pontecorvo, who defected to Moscow. Haven't covered National Radiological Protection Board, so the rather bleak looking building, UK HSA building. And I haven't covered anything about the sectors of it. I haven't covered bubble chamber area, computing, lasers, space, you name it. I haven't covered it. But,
any questions?
Well, you've demonstrated the importance of the planning's lunch. Have you got any similar suggestions for dealing with the current crisis?
Well,
you don't have to answer that.
Yeah, maybe the sticky topic, but well, no, this is the problem. I think the university did the whole world.
About that.
Yeah. I see we're coming. Can we stop recording?